Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks again for joining me. We have a great show for you, have a very interesting guest. And I would like for you to look me up on Facebook. Go to Randy Sutton Public Figure, like me, follow me, and you'll see all my posts of everything that I talk about, not only on the show, but for every single day I post at least one thing. So check me out there. Also, if you're a Twitterer, tweet me at LT Randy Sutton. I don't do Snapchat yet. So let's take a walk over to the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue.
The briefing room, headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
As you know, O.J. Simpson has been in the news. He was recently released from prison here in Nevada. And of course, O.J., Teflon O.J., had skated from the murdering episode that he did, where he carved up his wife, Nicole, and her friend, Ron Goldman. And in a sham of a trial, the jury basically did a jury nullification and found him not guilty, even though the evidence was absolutely overwhelming. I have very choice words for that jury. They're a bunch of idiots, and they decided to let him go based on race, and it was unconscionable what they did. But after he was found not guilty and he went off on his merry way, the Goldman family filed a civil suit against him, and the jury found an entirely different perspective. They ruled that he had murdered their son, Ron Goldman, as well as Nicole. And they found in the Goldman family's favor millions of dollars. But O.J., being the snake that he is, of course can't take responsibility for his own actions, has spent decades not paying the Goldmans what he is supposed to be paying. But I love the Goldmans. They have been dogged in their pursuit of this punk's assets. And it's been absolutely a family mission to make sure that that O.J. pays, at least in one way. Well, O.J. wound up getting a little Nevada justice when he did a robbery, trying to steal back some of his own memorabilia in a Las Vegas hotel room. And I can tell you that when that happened, he thought he was going to get off again. He honestly believes that that everybody's going to be charmed by his O.J. presence. And he got a little surprise when he was not only found guilty, but sentenced to multiple years in Nevada State Prison. And he served his time. And he's been out just a few months. Now, he wants to go back to Florida, which was just fine with us here in Nevada. And he's already been out showing his exactly who he is. He just got very publicly thrown out of the Cosmopolitan Hotel for acting the fool and getting drunk and being his usual obnoxious self. So he's not maintaining, shall we say, a low presence. He's out there in the limelight. Here's the thing. People are kissing his butt out there. He's going around and he's pretending that he's a star, and people in some cases are treating him like that, which I find absolutely abhorrent. But he's got a new lawyer. And, you know, listen, There are lawyers that I love. There's lawyers that I hate. I have a new lawyer that I hate, and it's OJ's new lawyer. So this guy is a Nevada attorney, and it's shocking what he has decided to say about the Goldman family. Now, this guy, Malcolm Laverne is his name. There are some lawyers absolutely turn my stomach, and he's one of them. Listen, when you need a lawyer, they're great to have. They're supposed to defend the rights of their clients. There's a lot of dedicated men and women out there who take up the law and do a fantastic job. And then there's the ambulance chasers. And then there are those who grandstand and who seek the limelight for themselves. And this Laverne, Michael Laverne punk is one of them. So the Goldmans want what is due to them legally. They want his assets. And O.J. Simpson is doing everything he can not to pay him. Everything. So what does this lawyer do? He calls the father of the murder victim. His name is Fred Goldman. He goes on Twitter and calls the family greedy and says, it calls him a plantation master, eager to obtain settlement money from the NFL player during a Twitter tirade this week. This punk, this disgusting human being, Malcolm Laverne, has the audacity to call the family of the murder victims that his client killed. He has the audacity to call them racist names. And he says, quote, "Money, money, money, money. I've heard the greedy Goldmans talk about money 1,000 times since they came on my radar screen in July, but only heard them mention that poor dead kid Ron a few times. Go figure." Really. And then he calls them greedy and a plantation master mentality. You know, do some lawyers completely devolve and lose their moral compass when they become lawyers? Because it certainly seems that this punk has. Now, he went on and he called the sister of Ron Goldman names on Twitter, and basically he demeaned the family. This guy is a punk, and O.J. Simpson is a piece of human garbage who is guilty of murder, and I hope that he stays in Nevada, and the next time he screws up, he gets a little bit more of the same thing. Now, while we're on the subject of, well, this is an entirely different subject. I'm not going to talk about lawyers anymore. I am, however, going to talk about an issue that came up relation to the murder of a police officer on Thanksgiving Day. A trooper was literally murdered in cold blood on Thanksgiving Day. He'd made a car stop on this punk, and when he walked away, the guy jumped out of the car with a rifle and shot him in the back. I mean, you talk about a coward. He killed this 15-year veteran and then tried to escape. He was apprehended in a field and arrested. Now, here's the problem. This guy never should have been out on the street. This guy was a serious bad guy who had committed violent felonies against law enforcement officers multiple times. He had beaten a deputy so badly that the photograph of this deputy looked like he had gone 10 rounds with Muhammad Ali. And he tried to take the officer's gun, which you know he would have killed him. In fact, he said he was going to kill him. And he was released, and a plea deal gave him a misdemeanor. And the district attorney who made the deal, when he was confronted with it, said he didn't remember. And this guy is now running for district attorney. When he was an assistant DA, he gave a plea deal he never should have given out. And then this guy offended again. And the judge released him on low bail on another violent felony against a law enforcement officer. This guy never should have been out of jail. And because he was, because of the liberal viewpoints of the attorney and the district attorney in previous cases, a trooper is dead. Three children are left fatherless. A wife is left without a husband. The criminal justice system only works when people who are involved in it do the job that they are supposed to do. If they're not going to, they shouldn't be allowed to participate in the criminal justice system. And we're seeing it over and over and over again. In fact, many states, including California and New Jersey, of course, are doing without bail entirely under the guise of, well, we can't keep poor people in jail. It would be unjust. So what they're doing is they are releasing violent felons, violent offenders to reoffend and reoffend and reoffend, all in the name of social justice. It's about time that we hold these people responsible and we allow victims to sue instead of giving them immunity. They hide behind that immunity. I also want to talk about a leadership issue. As you know, if you listen to me or read any of my postings, I talk about leadership, police leadership, all the time. And I got to tell you, I see some crazy, crazy stuff out there. The latest is the police chief in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Now, Bridgeport's a big town. And it has a lot of violent crime. Now, how out of touch with reality do you have to be when you are the chief of police and you find it offensive that police officers put the word police on the back of their jackets in reflective lettering so that they don't get hit by cars and they're readily identifiable, and you order them to take all patches that say police off their uniforms? What planet are you from? That's exactly what this guy did. He ordered his cops to take all the designators that said police off their uniforms. Now, the reason that people, that the police have the word police on there is because there have been so many cases where bad guys say, well, I didn't know he was a cop. So they have the word police on there. In addition to that, you have it in reflective lettering because it's safer. You don't get hit by the car that they pick up your reflective lettering and they know who the hell you are. So this moronic chief issues this stupid order. Well, one of the police officers who's involved in the union makes a statement about it, calling it exactly what it was, that this is a ludicrous order. Well, you know what that chief did? He suspended him. He suspended him for having the audacity to challenge his order. Now, this chief is such an idiot that instead of having a discussion, bringing the guy in, or dealing with it in some adult way, he suspends this guy. And now, what do you got? Now you got wholesale a feeling in the department of being led by an idiot. So you have a rebellion taking place because they see this quote leader, unquote leader, for exactly what he is, a megalomaniac, a guy that's willing to use his power and his position to punish someone for having an opinion and not agreeing with him. And the fact of the matter is, he's the one that's wrong. So I foresee that there will be true morale issues in the Bridgeport Police Department, and I wouldn't doubt that the union does a vote of no confidence in this idiot who's leading them. And that, my friends, is my view from the blue for this week. Before we take a walk into the interview room, one thing I wanted to let you know is that I recently had the honor of being a keynote speaker down in Texas. And I got to tell you that one of the things that I really enjoy is getting to meet personally with the people that listen to this radio program. So if you would like to talk to me about addressing your group, whether it is a law enforcement or a civic group or even a volunteer group, let me know. Contact me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. Thanks. Now let's take a walk into the interview room.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Well, the Out Loud perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutLoud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is a 17-year police veteran of a large state agency. We are keeping the name of the agency to a minimum here because he is not speaking officially for the agency, but only in his experience as a law enforcement officer. He has been a supervisor. He's had, well, we'll go into it with him, what his assignments have been, but he has a very interesting point of view about post-traumatic stress injury, and his experience with it is something that law enforcement officers and their families, I think, will get a really good understanding and a great perspective. I want to welcome James Hirth to the show. Thank you, James. Thanks for coming on Blue Lives Radio.
Good morning, Randy, and thank you for having me. I'm honored and appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you know, you and I had a really interesting discussion, and I was really interested in your perspective as to how you dealt with the issues that you dealt with and your agency's response to it. And I think that one of the things about post-traumatic stress injury is that everyone deals with it differently. And everyone, no two individuals are affected by critical incidents the same way. Some are cumulative. Some are specific to a certain type of incident that they were involved in. So when an individual such as yourself, who is an experienced law enforcement officer, goes through what is unfortunately becoming fairly common in our line of work, it's really interesting to find out how they dealt with it. So, first of all, let's go into your background just a little bit. You have a very varied background in law enforcement. You've been on, 12 years, correct?
That's correct. 12 years with my current department.
And did you have experience before that?
I did. Actually, I worked for the local district attorney's office and was also an auxiliary or volunteer officer with the local police department.
Gotcha. Okay. So, you know, you've had a number of different assignments. You've worked in patrol. What other assignments have you had?
Well, I was blessed and fortunate. I had the opportunity to work in a specialty section to help develop policy and training for the agency prior to being promoted. And when I got promoted, I oversaw field training for the entire agency in various capacities. And I feel because of my success in that position, I was asked to then supervise the backgrounds and selections process for the department.
Well, these were all very critical areas. But then you decided that you wanted to go back on the street.
I did. You know, it was very important for me to, you know, make sure that I am taking care of my personal life and my family. And the opportunity to come back to the field presented itself, which gave me the ability to be and work much closer to home. And so when it came available, I jumped at the opportunity, and I've been here ever since.
Let's get to your issue with post-traumatic stress. You know, you and I had a very lively discussion about it yesterday, and let's talk about what it was that that caused it and how you dealt with it.
Sure. So about almost 2.5 years ago, I was involved in a very critical incident of which a good friend and coworker of mine was critically injured in front of me, and one of our trainees, one of our cadets, was actually killed on scene. And not only was I directly involved in this incident, you know, we had a lot of other resources coming to us. So I then was one of the incident commanders, if you will, on scene. So I had various roles to play while going through a very, very traumatic event. And initially on scene, my concern was for the other officers that had responded. In fact, I had requested that first reports of injury be completed for each officer on scene. Unbeknownst to me, that I was also going to suffer from this, and in time realized that I also needed to take care of myself.
So you were on the scene when a friend, coworker, was critically injured, and another employee was killed. Did you witness this, or did you witness the aftermath?
I did. So it was a vehicle pursuit with a fleeing felon. And a good friend of mine, he's the one that was critically injured, per my request, was attempting to deploy tire deflation devices. And in the process of doing so, the suspect swerved and struck him, lost control, and struck our cadet and killed him instantly on scene.
And then you rolled up on the scene to see this carnage.
I observed it happen.
You watched it happen.
I did.
Wow. That so now after it happens, then becomes the investigation. You're still on the scene while they're being attended to, and you're in fact the incident commander.
I was. So you know, obviously going through years of training, it kicked in to allow me to do my job on scene, and that was to place the suspect in custody and to render first aid to my friend and colleague that was still conscious but very, very critically injured. And being a very dynamic scene and being fairly close to a large metropolitan area, we're very blessed to have a relationship with another local agency who then was able to take over the investigation for us. So there was an unbiased investigation involving the incident, since one of our own, actually two of our own members, were critically injured and one of them was killed.
The suspect, you know, this is one of those incidents where the suspect is taken into custody after killing and trying to kill another law enforcement officer. And whenever I read those incidents take place, I flash back to some of my own experiences where I wished I had, or, you know, kind of fantasized that I didn't take him into custody when what he richly deserved was the immediate death penalty. But, you know, because we are professionals, we do what's necessary to do legally, and morally as well. But that still plays a factor in recreating that in your mind, does it not?
Absolutely does. I was very close to using deadly force justifiably in that situation, as the suspect was not obeying verbal commands. And once he was proned out, it appeared to me that he was reaching for a weapon. He was not, and luckily, I did not have to use deadly force that day. And it's interesting, as I did a debrief with other recruits in the academy about this incident, one of them had asked, you know, basically if I got some. In other words, if I had to go hands-on with this guy and kind of give him what he deserved. And I think we'd all like to think that that would be, you know, a great outcome, but realizing, too, that we're subject to statutes, to policies, and just to ethical decisions we make. And so, no, I relied upon my training. It kept me safe and allowed me to do my job and take the suspect into custody. And I'm pleased to report that going through the criminal justice process, he's been convicted of first-degree murder, extreme indifference. So he will no longer see the light of day again. And although that doesn't change the situation and bring back, you know, our lost cadet, and won't ever change the emotional injuries and the physical injuries that were sustained that day, but it's at least a little bit of justice that we can acknowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. So this incident happens, how long ago did this take place?
It was in May of 2015.
All right, we're talking fairly recent. It's only a couple years ago. And was this the first critical incident that you had been involved in?
No, it was not. I've been in various vehicle pursuits, never deadly force encounters, but I've had off-duty issues as well. In particular, my daughter, when she was very young, about 2 weeks old, she had developed late-onset GBS meningitis, had a stroke and seizures, and almost died as a result of it. And that's really the first time I would say that I had some emotional triggers and was diagnosed with a post-traumatic stress injury. And that was about 6 years ago.
And then this takes place 2 years ago. And then there was and then you also were diagnosed yourself with a life-changing illness.
I was, you know, and unrelated to the vehicle pursuit, about 2 weeks afterwards, was seeing a neurologist for some complications I was having and was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And
2 weeks after the critical incident, 2 weeks after this pursuit.
Yes, 2 weeks after seeing a friend and colleague killed and one injured, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor.
Well, that's more than most people should have in a lifetime. But so when did you start feeling the effects of post-traumatic stress?
You know, it took a little bit of time. I mean, early on, I was having a lot of flashbacks and really what if-ing the entire account of my actions and everyone's actions the day of the pursuit. And almost immediately, I was having some sleep issues, the sensitivity to noises, just bad dreams. But I thought that was all fairly normal and would subside over time. And I'm a very extroverted individual, so I found it beneficial to talk about it, and which definitely helped. But I feel like it was kind of masking, you know, bigger issues. And over time, along with compounding issues for my own personal medical health, you know, I eventually reached out and said, I need help. You know, I think more often than not, you know, being the type A personality individuals we are, you know, we can deal with stuff ourselves. We don't talk about it. We hide behind things. It's faux pas or taboo to discuss our emotions in the profession.
Very true.
And, you know, immediately, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Did your department do any type of debrief or psychological debrief, offer any interviews with a psychologist after the critical incident, as many agencies do?
So the same day of the incident, we had multiple chaplains that had responded to the hospital, which is where my friend was being treated, and we had a fairly mini debrief, and then I think within a couple of weeks, we had a larger, more formalized critical incident debrief.
Did you find it helpful?
I found the day of was helpful, but I was also guarded. I was very emotional. I was very sad what had happened. I felt my actions directly contributed to this. Had I not worked this shift this day, a young man would still be alive. My friend would not have the injuries that he sustained. And over time, I would find that I am not the one to blame for this. The individual to blame is in prison.
Exactly. Exactly. So you began blaming yourself for the outcome of this. And
I did.
And that started taking an emotional toll.
I did. And one of the worst things I did was being very savvy with watching the news is watching what the media is saying about this. And even internally, the gossip, the rumor mill, and I would say the lack of transparency throughout the department as to what happened. And unfortunately, you know, the human brain will tend to fill in blanks. If you don't know, you're going to put in, you know, maybe a worse account of what happened.
That's interesting.
And that really took its toll on me. Yes.
So I want to talk about that for a second, because that's an interesting point of view. The agency didn't disseminate the information about what took place, and so did that start some rumors getting going in the department internally?
It absolutely did. It absolutely did. And even to this day, there are still some unknowns as to what happened. And it's tough because it's put me more on the defensive, where I feel like I need to clarify what happened so people know how to protect themselves, so they know what happened, and so that, you know, they can keep themselves safe.
That's interesting.
And I'll talk about officer safety in a little bit. I think there's a whole paradigm shift as a culture in law enforcement we need to look at, and not just that on-scene physical safety. Emotional, the civil, the administrative, it's bigger picture.
Go into the depth a little more in that. What do you mean by that?
So we all go through training. You go through your academy, your field training programs, in services, shift debriefings, use of force scenarios, firearms, arrest control. We go through all this training, the mental rehearsal, the what if, which is some of the best things you can do, in my opinion, as an officer, is to have that mental rehearsal, the what if. It's going to keep you safe so you go home at the end of the day. I think we're missing the mark. And what I mean by that, if as leaders in the law enforcement profession, we retrain to say officer safety is not just the physical, but it is the emotional. It's the civil, the administrative. How do you take care of that officer so he or she gets home safely and doesn't just quote unquote survive the incident, but that they can re-engage and still have some normalcy with their life? Well, the way I have viewed things is every time I've been blessed to take on a new opportunity in my profession is, what resources do I have available to successfully do my job? Well, I would challenge all of us to do the mental rehearsal on a critical incident. What am I going to do when things hit the fan, when this goes bad? Who can I reach out to? What resources do I have available through my department? Do I have a department psychologist, a peer support team, you know, employee assistance programs, coworkers, family, church? I feel you're going to be much more successful if a critical incident occurs and you have some of this established in your head that I'm not alone. Okay, here's who I can go to get assistance, or here's what I should avoid doing. There's a lot of things I found that helped me through the process. There's things I found that were very challenging, and it takes time. You know, that's the great thing about this being treated as an injury. It is healable. You're not alone. There's resources to help you, but you need to speak up and you need to seek help. And don't be scared. Don't be embarrassed. It doesn't matter how tough you are, how masculine, feminine, how much experience you have. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, post-traumatic stress is an equal opportunity injury. There's no doubt about that.
That it is indeed.
What were the symptoms that you started developing where you knew that there was an issue?
I was having reoccurring dreams as the court process started to ensue. Just how, which is not untypical regarding how attorneys can be inside the courtroom, but I was having some very disturbing dreams and nightmares about the court process. And of course, about the critical incident itself. I was experiencing a lot of depression and withdrawal, anxiety, sensitive to noises. And then longer term, I realized because of probably being outspoken, I was losing relationships with friends and family. They didn't know how to deal with this. And sometimes I just needed a shoulder. I just wanted somebody to listen to me.
Right.
And it was tough because I've taken a lot of proactive steps myself to get assistance, to include private therapy, doing good diet, exercise, EMDR, which is specific treatment for a post-traumatic stress injury. By the way, it's very helpful.
I was gonna get into that for a little bit. Just real quickly, EMDR is, I forget what it stands for, eye movement.
Desensitization and reprocessing.
There we go. And it has been in use in the last several years very effectively for post-traumatic stress, and you found that it was helpful for you.
Absolutely. And there's a couple different ways that my therapist could administer it, either having there's like paddles they have in your hands that oscillate from left to right and they vibrate in different patterns, or through the use of headphones with sounds or tones that oscillate back and forth. And all while going through a therapy session, there's different things that will come out, which is very intriguing on the correlation on some of the things that you'll discuss going through treatment. And it's not easy. It's tough. Initially, I thought set me back. I was very emotional going through it, but I did start to see the benefits of it. And I would go through about 1 hour per week for several months. And much like, you know, a typical injury, it does take time to heal. It's not something that, you know, you typically get it going for one session or got to slap some medication on it and call it good.
Yeah, exactly. When you were going through the crisis part, I mean, did it actually develop into a crisis, or was it more of a build up where it was affecting your life, but it didn't drive you into a deep depression, or did it?
Well, I would say I was still able to function, so I wasn't in complete crisis mode. Having the introspect and looking at how I changed, I realized that something is wrong. I'm not myself. I'm not as upbeat and as engaged as I need to be. And unfortunately, also having, you know, the brain tumor I was diagnosed with, which the irony was at the emotional control center of the brain between the amygdala and the hippocampus, which is also the area that is affected by a post-traumatic stress injury. So I got kind of a double whammy.
No kidding. Well, just out of curiosity, what happened with the brain tumor?
So, well, in the midst of going through the criminal court proceedings for the pursuit, I had requested a trial deposition because I decided that I was going to go through and have surgery. And I had requested a deposition because it wasn't about me. It was about, you know, two men and their families that will forever be affected from this. So I wanted a deposition to have my testimony recorded in case I died in surgery. And so I'm probably
that's a hell of a decision to make.
Let's say embrace the suck. It was rough.
I guess. Wow, what a thing to.
So
you decided to have the surgery, and of course, you know, you're talking about a brain tumor. It's you literally are facing a life changing type of treatment.
It was, and. I'm proud to say that I had the surgery. It was non-cancerous, and I am vertical and blessed this day and doing well.
That's great to hear. Great to hear. So then you go through the trial. During that time period, did you find that your symptoms were exacerbated?
I would say that they were stable at that point because I focused more of the efforts on what needed to be said for trial. I tried to push focus on my feelings and my emotions and focus on being successful at my job. And my job was to provide an accurate account of what had happened that day. And I did so. And then after the trial commenced and the sentencing, and I think that's where I started to struggle again, is because at that point I can focus back on myself and realize I still needed assistance.
So did you, How long did you continue with treatment before you felt that you no longer needed it?
It was off and on for several months, and that's where having a very open dialogue with the therapist was helpful, to say you can see that progression and how that EMDR and that desensitization was working. I wasn't feeling triggered by certain events. I was getting better sleep, although with the profession having a rotating schedule doesn't assist that, but it's the nature of the beast. But it did. It took some time, and slowly I felt better and better. I felt more confident because of the resources provided to me through therapy that I could handle this and that I was stable.
Now, that, you took a very proactive approach. Now, you and I also had a brief discussion about a book written by a very good friend of mine who I think is one of the great books for all law enforcement officers and their families to read, called Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement by Dr. Kevin Gilmartin. Did you find that that was helpful to you in understanding the situation you were dealing with?
I do. You know, in my career, and I was, as an agency, our chief, this is probably maybe 6 or 7 years ago, mandated and actually provided each officer a copy of this book, mandated that we would read it, and actually provided compensation to read it. And, you know, being a fairly young officer at the time, I thought, okay, well, you know, as an order, absolutely. I went through and read it, and it was very eye-opening. And what really stood out to me is over-identifying in the profession. You know, it's right. Very, very admirable work that we do, but it's very easy to over-identify. And then when you do go through these challenges, it really causes major struggle. And you got to take a step back and say, what else are you? Who are you outside of the profession? What we do is incredibly important. If not us, then whom? But you also need to look at who you are, father, wife, husband, sister, brother. You know, you've got other things that identify you. Don't let the profession dictate just who you are as a person.
Exactly. You know, and I want to talk about that for a second, about your family. Now, you have a wife and you have children. How did the post-traumatic stress affect your relationships with them?
You know, it was really tough. I found I was not as engaged with my kids. I wasn't as happy. I wanted to avoid going out into large crowds and things that they enjoyed doing. And so not only did it isolate me, it isolated my family from doing the things that they love to do. I'm very blessed that my wife is my best friend and that I could talk to her very openly through this. She's been my number one supporter, you know, through and through since we've been together for 16 years. And it's taken its toll. And that's where I feel being open about things and trying to work together. So this is not an individual challenge you're going to go through to get treatment for this type of an injury. And the children, the kids, they don't understand it. They don't know.
Of course.
My kids are 6 and 4. So, you know, they were pretty young when things happened and they don't understand the changes that they saw in me. And like I said, I'm pleased to report with time, I'm re-engaging and things are good on the up and up.
That's great. That's great to hear. Let's go back to your department for a second. What did they do right and what could they have done better?
I think what they did, what they could do better is having which I think going through the event that I went through has changed some protocols and how the agency handles things. But really sitting down and working with anybody involved in a critical incident. I think, second to that, statutorily, realizing on workers' compensation that a first report of injury is completed and that they do have follow-up protocols in place to ensure that you get the assistance you need. Well, I actually attempted to go through and file a first report of injury through workers' compensation. This is well after the incident, so this is almost a year after. And a workers' compensation adjuster, when I'm telling her the whole story over the phone about what had happened during the pursuit and how I saw a coworker killed and one injured in front of me, and she had the audacity to tell me that, well, that's what you guys train for. No.
Wow.
So needless to say, that crushed me. That ripped open the scar again.
Oh, I can
and,
imagine.
You know, my training, yeah, it, you know, and yeah, that was terrible. And so I think making sure as an agency that you know who's going to be speaking to your officers in a time like this. Don't just check a box. Go through and make sure that you have, you know, a purposeful step that is taken to assist your people. You know, one of the best things I did and that the agency did was having the open communication from me all the way up to my chief. Now, I don't know if I would have been afforded that opportunity had I not been blessed enough to be in some pretty high-level overseeing programs where I had a constant dialogue with our chief and our executive command. And when I was at my low point, I reached out to my chief directly, and I was in fear of repercussions. In any type of a paramilitary organization, you don't do that.
Right.
You have very strict protocols and chain of command, and I was at my low point. I thought, well, worst case they can do is terminate me.
which many police officers have unfortunately felt that the sting of that when going for help.
They do. They don't get the support they need, and I think it's some of the old school versus new school leadership styles. We don't talk about this and deal with it. It's just the nature of the work we're in. Well, I disagree with that. And I'm proud to say, too, our state's actually changed to recognize a post-traumatic stress injury to be covered through workers' compensation for first responders and not just officers.
That's really important, so, because there are still many states and many agencies that do not recognize post-traumatic stress as a workers' compensation injury. Was that done statutorily?
That was changed statutorily within the past, I think, year and a half.
Interesting. That's good to hear. But, you know, you did receive support from your chief.
I did. And the irony going through all of this is having a very open dialogue with him, and I knew that he had my back at different levels below him. I don't know how much. I went through an administrative review, which pursuant to policy is very appropriate. I welcomed it. We had, you know, very open discussion about policy and training and equipment. And, you know, I looked at it as an opportunity to help others if they go through an event like this. What do we need to be able to successfully do our jobs? Is there something that's lacking? How can we do things different? Where things I felt were wrong is the rumor mill through the agency, the gossip, the people filling in the blanks and talking behind my back. And that's not something that you can change. I mean, that's unfortunate, you know, to be a culture with the agency. But, that was really tough for me to go through.
You know, when you examine this time in your life and what you went through, how do you feel that it has changed you as a police officer and as a person?
Funny you say that. As a police officer and as a supervisor, I really look at every situation and training in terms of liability. And this is not just I'm going to protect the agency and prevent the agency from getting sued. It's looking at I'm going to take care of my people. Now, we're all humans. People make mistakes. And so I talk with my team about doing the right thing for the right reason. Mistake is made. Own up to it. We'll work through it. But I look at situations very critically. And it's to protect them because of what I went through. I don't want anyone to have to go through that, to have that on their shoulders. And so
we've got to wrap it up, unfortunately. We're running out of time. But one thing I wanted to ask you, during some of my, I also, you know, went through some issues. I also believe in post-traumatic stress growth. Is that something that you experienced as well?
You know, I don't know about resiliency. What I've, you know, learned going through therapy is once you've had a post-traumatic stress injury, you are potentially more susceptible to having a reoccurring injury. And so I don't know. I would say I hope I don't go through another critical incident, but hope is not a plan.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know yet. I think time will tell.
Fair enough. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Your perspective is fascinating. It reveals that there are that each of us deals with these issues individually, differently, and with the support of people who love you and an agency that cares enough to get involved, that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutloud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we honor those men and women of the law enforcement field who have made the ultimate sacrifice and given their lives in the line of duty. Unfortunately, this week I have two names to read. Both these officers were killed on the same day, murdered. The first, Trooper Damon Allen of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Texas Highway Patrol. Trooper Damon Allen was shot and killed while making a traffic stop on I-45 in Freestone County, just south of Fairfield at approximately 4 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day. He had contacted the driver and was returning to his patrol car when the man exited his car and opened fire with a rifle. Trooper Allen was killed at the scene. The man was located in Waller County several hours later and taken into custody after exchanging shots with officers. Trooper Allen had served with the Texas Highway Patrol for 15 years. He is survived by his wife, three children. Trooper Damon Allen, Texas Department of Public Safety, Texas Highway Patrol. End of watch Thursday, November 23rd, 2017. The second is Deputy Sheriff Eric Overall of the Oakland County Sheriff's Office in Michigan. Deputy Sheriff Eric Overall was struck and killed by a suspect vehicle as he attempted to deploy stop sticks at approximately 12:30 a.m. Officers began pursuing the vehicle in the parking lot of the Lapeer County Jail after the man made threats against law enforcement. The pursuit traveled into Oakland County on I-69, where the vehicle exited on M-15. Deputy Overall had deployed stop sticks and had taken up a position well off the roadway. The driver of the vehicle intentionally drove off the roadway and struck Deputy Overall. The subject's vehicle then overturned. Pursuing officers immediately took the man into custody. He had served with the Oakland County Sheriff's Office for 22 years. Deputy Sheriff Eric Overall, Oakland County Sheriff's Office, Michigan. End of watch, Thursday, November 23rd, 2017. These officers gave their lives in the line of duty. May they rest in peace. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. Now, I'm your host, Randy Sutton. You can find me at Facebook. If you look under Facebook and you see Randy Sutton Public Figure, just like that or follow it, and you can see everything that I write and post. You can communicate with me there as well. I answer all of my messages personally. You can also find me at Twitter at LT Randy Sutton, LT Randy Sutton at Twitter. And you can find my books at Amazon.com. I have four books, and I think you'll like them. A Cop's Life, True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them, True Blue to Protect and Serve, and The Power of Legacy. Thanks again.